Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
And hey, I met you. You are not cool.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am too smart. S-M-R-T. I mean, S-M-A-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
Stick around.
Visit us at IHateCritics.net. We're also at EveryonesACriticPodcast.com. IHateCritics.com. We're all over the place. We're also new to Libsyn, so I don't know what that means to you, if you can even tell, but...
Library syndrome.
Yeah.
No. That's not what it means.
You had me. I was thinking library syndicate, library syncing. No, and then when you said it so matter-of-factly...
Liberal singularity.
I'm not falling for this shit until Bob says it. No, he's going to troll me, too. I have the internet.
I know what it is, and I just, off the top of my head, I can't. Now you're going to make me look. Liberated syndication.
Oh.
Gotcha. No, it's not. It really is. But we're on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and hopefully soon TuneIn and Spotify. We're not right now, but the goal of going to Libsyn was to get us on Spotify. So hopefully we'll be there as well in the coming weeks. Please, no matter where you are, though, go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts and find Everyone's a Critic. Subscribe to our one with the funny cartoon logo, not the other ones. And subscribe to the podcast, rate and review the show. We will read your review on the air. And then if you want to support the podcast, IHateCritics.net/Patreon. That's the best way to help us out. You get a credit on the show. We're growing the show. We actually just had a meeting, and we've actually started mapping the book out. We're going to not just lip service anymore. We're actually going to start working on it all the way. We have the 100 movies. We have the other things we want to talk about in the book, and it'll start moving forward as soon as today. So, and your support helps us out there, and video was talked about, other things. So, yeah, keep helping us out. And look like you're going to say something, or
I got nothing.
That helps us out the best. And then if you kind of want to help out too, IHateCritics.net, there's a little Star Wars Amazon link thing you can click on. If you go there before shopping at Amazon, we get a piece of, like a very small piece of your purchase, like a couple pennies or something like that. But it adds up.
Do we get extra if they shop for Star Wars things on Amazon?
I don't think so.
Because I can do this, you know.
Yeah, that would, I mean, just if you shop at Amazon, yeah, go to our site.
Okay.
We'll start with the news and trailers, which is, we're just going to talk about
like
one
a trailer. There was a big trailer or something released this week?
I hear.
I didn't watch it. I did. But
Avengers Infinity War, Josh.
Yeah, it's a big trailer. It's got a lot of stuff in it. It's really neat and important at certain times, I suppose. Doctor Strange is in Hellraiser. I don't know what happened there, but fine. More than anything, everyone's going to go see this movie.
Will you tell them why you're going to boycott it?
Why I'm going to boycott? Yeah! Listen here. Hawkeye is such an unappreciated character. He's so cool. Like, I get Marvel Comics every once in a while, and I'll get Ant-Man and Hawkeye, because that's like, they've just got more personality. They don't really have powers, per se. They have crap that helps them. You know, I like those kind of superheroes a little bit more. Like Batman, of course. But Jeremy Renner is not in the movie, according to one of the Russo brothers, the directors of Infinity War. And he's not on the poster. But not just that, he's not in the movie. As the Russo brothers try and explain away with crappy reasons, he's on his own journey. In other words, we cut his scenes. And I just think that that's horseshit. I mean, if they moved his scenes to the fourth Avengers film, fine. But it really does bug me that one of the guys that started out with you, he was in Thor to begin with, is not in the conglomeration of all of these people for the first time. Why?
Because he's back home taking care of his family.
But why was he not doing that in Civil War? You know, he's in the prison at the end of Civil War.
This is like
I didn't see a lot of space in the. I mean, I saw some, of course.
There's going to be space in this because Thanos is coming from space. Guardians are coming from space. This is a bigger threat than they've ever faced before, and they sent him home to take care of his kids. Everybody else doesn't have kids to take care of.
And I guess arrows can't really do anything to Thanos, maybe. I don't know.
I'm betting, from what I've seen.
Josh sounds like a Hawkeye fan.
I am.
Like an Iowa Hawkeye.
I am.
I hadn't heard that he wasn't in the movie. That's news to me. I knew he wasn't on the trailer and a lot, or the poster, and a lot of people made a big deal about him not being in the poster. He tell me he didn't take time to film the house instead of doing this. Jerry Renner was
sent him
in
home
the house,
and they let him do that.
Well, he's starting to become an actor that, like, I like Jeremy Renner a lot. Okay, maybe he doesn't always choose well, but okay, he's not. He wasn't in Jason Bourne, even though the previous film involved the continuing story of stuff he was involved in. He wasn't even in the movie or referenced as Aaron Cross. And then now he's in a major franchise again, and he's kind of just pushed to the side. There's nothing wrong about Jeremy Renner. He's not like so put-offing like a Nicolas Cage is polarizing for people.
And he's not going to be in that new Dahmer movie either.
I think though when they say he's off on his own adventure, that does usually indicate something within the Marvel Universe that's happening, where he's leading into something like another one of the movies. He's going to be maybe
there's
going
to be a Hawkeye movie,
possibly. Or no. I'm thinking he's going to be in the post credits scene setting up the next movie.
I think that's perfectly understandable, believable. It just is one of those things that hit me as unfortunate.
On IMDb,
yes,
he is there. So I think he's in the post credits scene. And I think that's going to be a thing where he sets up the next movie.
But you do get listed
if you get
cut. If you cut out of the movie, you're still listed.
Yep.
So.
I'm calling my shot. I think that's what happens.
That would be great.
What would be even better? It. No post-credits scene. Just don't.
Never
do it.
Going to happen.
Make your own Avengers movie, Bob. You keep telling us what Marvel movie you want to see. Make one.
Hey, you've been with me, though. They've been a letdown the last couple.
Oh, Black Panthers was.
Well, no.
Sure,
Avenger.
Black Panther's a great movie. The post-credits scene, forget it.
Right. Agreed.
And then was there any other news other than Rob Zombie's doing a third?
That's right, news? Yes.
Ah, can't wait to bring that back to the show.
Well, that means that the end of Devil's Rejects is kind of a, you know, misnomer. Right?
Well, they just were wounded and are going to jail instead of going to hell, maybe? I don't know. Or maybe they're actually going to go down in hell and try to come out. I'm not really sure.
Ooh, the devil has actually rejected them.
Hey.
The title is Three from Hell.
Yes, that's true.
So I don't know that I want to. I didn't really have the budget to go to hell, but we'll see what he does.
Josh and I were both admiring something this week that was controversial on Twitter. Did you see this, Bob? The special Justice League trailer?
No.
They put out a 30-second trailer for Justice League, the DVD Blu-ray release, that was basically like the Justice League cartoon, but with the movie characters, and it was awesome. They had the announcer and everything. Did they even have the? They even had the voice, the effects, right? Like the.
Oh yeah! If you look at the video,
it was almost
it's
like the Super Friends,
like Super Friends.
Yeah, it was badass. And what these bunch of whiny little fanboys got all pissed off that it wasn't serious.
Sigh. If they wanted to get pissed off at something, get pissed off about the fact that there's no deleted, like there's two, three deleted scenes that only one of them matters, and we know that almost an entire film is on the cutting room floor, and they gave us that. I mean, the bonus features for Justice League, the conglomeration of our favorite characters, is horseshit. I looked at all of them. It is a joke, and it's just a circle jerk of the same people of DC that I have bemoaned for years.
I would watch a circle jerk between Aquaman and Superman. And
not
Batman.
The characters of the actors, the suits behind the scene. That's what they should whine about, not that cool little thing that Warner Brothers pulled because of the backlash. Like, man, at least I'm blaming Warner Brothers a little bit because, like, you got to own that.
Yeah.
Stick with it and don't worry about the things like fanboy.
Well, the biggest problem that you've had with these movies is that they're too serious, is that they've had this like this hanging tone of just being not fun.
Which I like. personally. Yes. And I don't know, the problem is that we're not making enough money. We're making tons of money, but we're not making enough. And that's, I don't know, if you're not happy with the money, either stop altogether or stay your course.
Yes, and they never once admit in these bonus features that the film, you know, isn't quite what they were looking for. They never address Zack Snyder's departure from the film and bringing Joss Whedon in. All the things that we would be interested in knowing. There's no commentary. They are glossing over every single thing about this project. And it just, man, if you're going to get mad at something, get mad at that and force a little bit of change. Then again, on Blu-ray.com, this past week, the actual release week of Justice League isn't in the top 10 talked about Blu-ray releases. That tells you stuff that's weeks out. Black Panther is on that list for pre-order, but not Justice League. That tells you something, and hopefully that kind of vote will just show these circle jerk individuals that you can't just rely on the name Batman and then get away with it forever. Ugh. Thank you for that, by the way. I appreciate it. I did not know that existed until you mentioned it.
There was one more piece of news that I also talked about on Twitter and I shared with you guys, and that is that there's a new director for the next James Bond movie.
Yes.
And this is interesting. It's going to be Danny Boyle. He's going to direct James Bond. And I was going over kind of my sort of weirdly mixed feelings about Danny Boyle. I like his stuff and I hate his stuff. I hate Slumdog Millionaire. I think that movie sucks. But The Beach, kind of, that one sucks. But like, he's got four movies that were in my, either at the top of or in my top 10. In the year that they came out, Millions, Steve Jobs, 127 Hours, and there was one other one that's now escaping me. But the bottom line is that, I mean, when he hits it right, he can make an absolute fucking masterpiece. But when he's off, it can suck. And I don't know where he's gonna fall on this. I didn't see the last Trainspotting because it didn't even make it to full release.
It pisses me off because I actually went and watched Trainspotting and already for it, and even found a way to kind of appreciate Trainspotting.
Yeah, that's one of the ones I hate right there is Trainspotting. But it's a heck of a choice in terms of changing over from the possibly stale idea of an English film like Sam Mendes was making. And for the last hurrah, you've got a guy that does kineticism well. Maybe that works well to take Bond to a particular different level. Not that as a whole on the podcast, we care about that. I do, but
I mean, if anybody's going to make the Bond villains do a circle jerk, that would be Danny Boyle.
Yeah.
Is Daniel Craig in or out?
He's in. This is his last Bond film.
Never mind then. Forget it.
You're hoping for Ewan McGregor?
I was hoping for anybody but Daniel Craig because Daniel Craig sucks. He sucks.
Just for that, I'm going to get my ticket in advance for the next Bond film. I'll be alone.
Speaking of circle jerks, our top five this week.
What's your top five? Who's your top five?
Is Irish theme movies for St. Patrick's Day. We just went that route because we didn't really have anywhere else to go this week. And we'll start with Instagram. Good Steve had number five, Good Will Hunting. 4, Patriots Day. 3, The Departed. 2, The Commitments. And 1, Boondock Saints with a wink and a tongue sticking out at us.
Yeah.
Well, they call him Good Steve, I guess. Jason from New Mexico and Cousin Jeff had 5 Leprechaun movies.
That's just horribly offensive. I'm sorry. I gotta say that as an Irishman, the my name is Sean Patrick, and the fact that they mention the Leprechaun movies is just—it's the most offensive stereotype in Irish culture. I'm terribly, awfully offended by this.
Your cousin Irish?
I would assume he's part Irish. Yes, bastard.
I had number 5, Miller's Crossing, 4, The Town, 3, The Fighter, 2, The Departed, 1, Good Will Hunting. Josh?
I have number 5 Irish films that came to mind. I'm sure that there are more that are set in Ireland or about Irish people that I have forgotten. 5 Patriot Games, there's some of it in Ireland.
Don't laugh when you read the next one.
Circle of Friends. No, I like that movie. Like
Circle Jerk of Friends.
Yeah. Pretty much anytime I'm talking, I'm trying to be funny. I'm not always succeeding, but I'm trying.
Why does my brain just reset every time to not expect being trolled?
Because you're a grown-up.
Oh. I guess that's a good thing. Number three is The Town. Two, The Departed, and one is Good Will Hunting. Not necessarily Irish films. They just involve...
They're in Boston.
Right.
I was struggling with with my list at the last minute, so I just went with movies in Ireland. I went with number five, Calvary, with Brendan Gleeson. Hell of a movie. Ondine, with Colin Farrell.
Ondine's on my list, too. Sorry, I forgot.
Brooklyn, which is half in Ireland. Sing Street. Love Sing Street. And Once.
My list sucks. You've just named two of the most obvious possible films that I could have chosen. Directed by an Irishman, set in Ireland. One's in my top 20. I suck.
Yeah.
Cheers, funny. Sir. Or Shlanta. However you say it. No.
Tomb Raider.
Tomb Raider, yes, with Alicia Vikander taking over for Angelina Jolie on this reboot of this franchise. Lara Croft, this time, she's lost her dad. He's been missing for 7 years. She doesn't want to admit that he's dead, so she's eschewed her fortune and has been living essentially in poverty as a bike messenger or bike delivery person. And basically, she's kind of forced to accept some of her money, or she tries to, and then she receives a gift from her dad that kind of gives her an indication where he might be, which leads her to this island, and that leads to eventually, at the end, we finally do actually raid a tomb, eventually. The movie called Tomb Raider. Finally, they do raid a tomb at some point. This movie's not bad. I mean, it had a very low bar based off of those awful two movies that they made of this franchise, and the fact that I don't think you can turn video games into movies very well. Most of the time when you watch a movie made from a video game property, it's like watching somebody else play a video game, and that's not fun. Unless you're like really, unless it's like your best friend and you're both kind, you know, you're trading back and forth real fast, you can each play, maybe that's fun, but generally speaking, if you're in a movie theater like that and you're watching other people, I don't understand what could be fun about that. It's certainly not fun for me. And so I've had that experience of watching these video game movies and just watching somebody else play. And it's like, I want to play.
I wish it were fun, though, because then my son would let me play and I wouldn't have to let him.
But this movie doesn't have that feel. They get away from that. And they make a straight-up action movie. And they make it well enough that because Alicia Vikander is having fun doing it. And she's not an actress known for having fun. She's an actress who, kind of like David Oyelowo last week in Gringo, he's an actor who's known for being very serious. And he's having a lot of fun in that movie. And here Alicia Vikander looks like she's having fun for the first time in her career. And I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed seeing her have fun. And the direction is fun. The action scenes are fun. There's a bicycle chase that has absolutely nothing to do with the plot, but it's well shot and it's kind of exciting. I kind of got into it. The scene that's in the trailer, they gave far too much away of the scene where she falls into the raging rapids and is headed towards the waterfall. It's actually a pretty great sequence. If they hadn't given so much of it away in the trailer, it would be a little bit better. But I really liked the payoff. Just one word. She has one word. But I laughed out loud at that one word payoff. It works for me. And that scene worked. Walton Goggins is doing his crazy Walton Goggins thing. I said in my written review, and I stand by it, that he's either going to – he has a choice depending on his work. He's either going to end up being the new age Christopher Walken or the new – subpar Dennis Hopper. Like that's where Walton Goggins is heading. He's got to make his choice now, which one he wants to be. I like this movie. I recommend it.
Did you see Tomb Raider?
No.
Okay.
I took the week off.
All right. I saw this and I love this movie. It is fun as hell. Now, I think a lot of it has to do with what you stated was a very low bar compared to not just other Tomb Raider films, that I saw both of, and they're just god-awful. I mean, it's brutal. even if Angelina Jolie looks like the pixelized version of Lara Croft, that's fine. But I had a very low thought for this movie even going in. But like, I had this thing in the back of my head. We watched the trailer, and I said, the trailer is actually not bad. It seems to take itself seriously. The first 10, 20 minutes of the film, I remember the bicycle chase scene and said, well, that's kind of smart, smarter than it should be, right? But the camera's kind of moving around a little bit. It's a little jiggly, and I'm wondering who's directing this the whole time, because if this is the way the movie's going to be, my head's going to hurt at the end of it because of the way that the camera moves. But then she gets to this island looking for her father, played by Dominic Cooper. And Dominic West, thank you. Different actor. Dominic Cooper's Howard Stark. Okay. Dominic West usually sucks in everything I see him in. He's a very pretty man, but he's a terrible actor. In this particular case, I still would have preferred somebody else in the role, but he's serviceable in an important role as her father. She gets to the island, and all of a sudden, this movie really does start to take itself more seriously than it should, and that is good. It works for this material. At some point, I'm thinking to myself, am I really having this much fun at Tomb Raider? I am. And in Walton Goggins, he serves less of a purpose than the overall purpose, which is some evil corporation that is trying to destroy the world with something. But the way that they take her character and make her not necessarily a superhero, she does things that are incredible, yes, but it's set up to a point where you start to believe that what she does makes sense. They show her fighting earlier on in the film and losing, but also she's more skilled than, say, you or I at kickboxing, okay? They show her shooting a bow and arrow at home early in her childhood, so when she picks up a bow and arrow, you believe that she's capable of it. And when she climbs rocks and whatnot, it makes sense to a certain extent. Does she take a lot of damage in this one? Yes, and there's something about Alicia Vikander's performance here in that she lets out cries and screams that are actually kind of believable, that she's in a lot of pain, that she's suffering through this, and that she isn't quite Lara Croft yet. That the whole thing works out for me to a point where I was thinking, yes, this is a rote situation. We've seen like three stanzas of levels to a tomb before in Indiana Jones films. We'll talk about it, of course, soon. But it really worked for me to the point where I'm excited for what they did with this movie and want to actually see more. It is way better than I expected it to be. I kind of want to take my son to it, too. I didn't get a chance to, but yeah. One last thing I'll say about it, because I've been rambling, of course, but there's a scene in this film where she's approached in the rain and in the dark and in the jungle by a soldier, a mercenary, and you think that she's going to be toast because it's a mercenary, right? He's not only does he have an automatic weapon, but he's a mercenary, so he's going to defeat her for sure. But the film makes a smart choice by putting it in the deep, like, rain. Okay, it's muddy. It's in the forest. It's dark. And so the odds are kind of more even than they should be. And the film is brutal in this moment in that they're really fighting. I mean, really fighting. Some blood is flowing, you know, things like that. And what she does is like a very pivotal moment for the character. I said, I mean, I'm really watching Tomb Raider in this moment. This is good stuff. So it does what I ask this stuff to do, which is elevate source material. And that makes me so effusive about it.
Yeah, this would have been the one I would have gone to. I've gone to a lot of movies lately, mm-hmm. and the wife asked me not to this week, so I didn't.
Yeah, it's fun. I did have like some moments of like where I was questioning the survivability, at least of one particular scene that was kind of a bit of more than a bit of a stretch. But I
parachute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was so well staged. It really so well staged that I didn't mind it so much. There's also an episode of The Dollop, if you listen to that podcast, where there's a woman who crawls up who lived through basically being nude, not eating for 7 days, and having to crawl down a mountain. And she lives for at least several more years after that. That kind of has changed my perspective on what people can survive.
Was she in a Peter Berg film?
Anything else on Tomb Raider?
So better than it should be. don't stay till post credits. I read an article that's...
There's a post credit scene?
There's not. Okay. I clicked on, is there a post credit scene? And then went through something that said, those of you interested in blah, 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 blah. And that said, spoilers ahead. I'm like, oh, okay, well, I better put it down and stay till the end credits. The spoiler said the last scene of the film is the post-credit scene. I'm like, that's not post-credits, you asshole article. It was like somebody telling me about Split last year, you know, in a headline. So
that's a whole lot of fan service in that ending. That's all that was. But
agreed.
Love, Simon.
Love, Simon, yes. This is a basically a movie about a teenage boy who's trying to decide how to come out. He's 17 years old. He was gay for about 3-4 years, but hasn't told anyone. His closest friends, his family, they don't know. He sees a post on this sort of school blog from another kid who's thinking of coming out but hasn't. And the two begin a kind of a correspondence via Gmail, back and forth talking about, you know, various reasons why they haven't come out, how they discovered themselves, that kind of thing. And they begin to kind of develop a romance. Meanwhile, of course, he's dealing with trying to figure out how to come out. He's got a kid who finds out about him, who starts blackmailing him to try and get a date with one of his friends. It's a sitcom. I mean, really, it is. A lot of people have talked about this movie being revolutionary. It's got it's something important. And in some ways it is. In that, you know, gay people deserve to have the same kind of rote, middle of the road, modest entertainment that straight people have. This is kind of like I was comparing it to, say, you know, if a movie like Bex is like a gay version of Once, then this is kind of the gay version of You've Got Mail. It's like You've Got Mail's not bad. It's not art. It's not. It's as much a sitcom as anything, elevated by maybe having movie stars in it. But it's just kind of a sitcom idea. And this is kind of a sitcom idea made by a guy who specializes in television, Greg Berlanti, who's bringing us kind of middle of the road perspective to all that CW superhero nonsense. That's kind of what he's done throughout his career. He's a very middle of the road director, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with the movie. It's a charming, sweet, funny. If it were on TV weekly, I would watch it. But it's not a work of art. It's not revolutionary. It's not something that's particularly memorable. And not every movie has to be Call Me By Your Name. I'm not, but that's a nice aspiration for people to have when they're making movies like this, to have something artful in mind. This is a sitcom. It's a particularly good sitcom, but to make anything more of it, its place in the culture is more revolutionary for just how mundane and kind of middle of the road it is, and that we've reached a place in our culture where we're making those movies for gay audiences now, or for all audiences, but about a gay character.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of having a light bulb go off. I hated the trailer. I thought it was I was worried it was trying to be revolutionary, but instead, no, they're just making a movie, and the main character happened to be gay.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that that's the revolutionary part, is that they can make a mundane, middle-of-the-road, kind of a romantic comedy that happens to have gay characters. Not for gay audiences. I don't mean to limit it that way. I mean, it's for all audiences. It's just a movie that happens to be about gay characters. Kind of like Bex is a romantic comedy that happens to have a lesbian couple at the center.
Had I seen Greg Berlanti as the director, which I had not done until this moment, I would have completely washed it away from my memory. His shows on the CW, The Arrow, The Flash, The Legends of Tomorrow, they're so god-awful. Like,
people love them, though.
Oh, for whatever reason. Because it is a soap opera involving superheroes and like bad soap opera stuff. And you've got second rate actors doing stuff.
You're talking to two pro wrestling fans.
Fine.
Set this 20 years ago and it's Dawson's Creek with superheroes. Like, that's what these are.
That's it.
It's like Dawson's Creek and Buffy.
Yep.
But Buffy's a better movie, better show, but I mean...
It's not Smallville?
No, that's... Greg Berlanti was on that show, too. The whole thing is garbage, and I was excited at first, like, oh, Arrow's got his own show, you know, right? So I start watching, and I'm like, this sucks. I'm getting rid of my copy, like, because I just bought it sight unseen. No, that's the bad idea. Greg Berlanti is a terrible, terrible creative mind in terms of superheroes. So that would have turned me off to the film.
You're so mean. I have yet to watch any of them.
So. I expect more.
That said, we ended on a very negative note there, but I did kind of sort of recommend this movie. I do recommend the movie. It's good enough for what it is.
So you've got mail.
Yeah, it's You've Got Mail.
All right. I'm not going to be able to pronounce this last word. 7 days in...
Entebbe.
Entebbe.
Yes, this is Rosamund Pike and Daniel Brühl starring in a true story about a real-life hijacking that took place in 1976. Two Germans and two Palestinian nationals took over a plane that was headed from Israel to Paris and redirected to Entebbe in Uganda, which, of course, at the time was overseen by Idi Amin, who people might remember from the Forrest Whitaker movie. He's a crazy man. He's just absolutely insane. And here we get to see a really great Idi Amin. I don't have the actor's name in my head, but I should. But he's a great Idi Amin. He really combines all the best elements of an Idi Amin. But maybe the best thing in this movie, unfortunately, and he's a very minor character. This is a movie that's attempting to be sort of an art film and an action movie at the same time, and it's doing that in order to avoid its muddled politics, because we're talking about German nationals, but they're left-wing German nationals, meaning they're anti-fascist, and they see Israel as a fascist state, which is a weird thing to wrap your mind on. They literally state in the movie that they see Israel as a function of the Nazis, which I know sounds weird. They have a rationale to them. There's that shoving all the Jews into one place is like putting them in their own state-sanctioned concentration camp in the middle of all their enemies. Like that's they think that in many ways they've roundabouted their politics into thinking that they're defending Jewish people as opposed to what they're doing. They're also on the side of the Palestinians, who they see as more as being treated like Jews during World War II, as they talk about this in the movie. But again, that's such a complicated idea to try and put into an action movie, and they don't really come around on that idea very well. They try and do that with a lot of dialogue. The dialogue gets very heavy at times, and people kind of are going to nod off during those portions trying to put together how left-wing Germans are opposed to Israel, but they're not Nazis. It's weird. It's a weird thing to try and wrap your head around. The best part of the movie for me is that the artful part, they try and wrap in this ballet that's taking place. One of the Israeli soldiers who's going to Entebbe to free the hostages has a girlfriend who's a ballet dancer. And this ballet is incredible. The music is amazing. It's all Israeli music, really heavy drums. I think it's Yiddish. I'm not sure the language exactly. I'm not good at that. But the language is amazing. It's a foreign tongue, and it's incredible. And I loved those scenes. And I actually rather would watch the ballet than the history drama that's going on. It's for the most part accurate what happened, but I don't recommend this movie because it's just too muddled. They don't really have a good solid focus. They're trying to make an art film and an action movie, and the two sides just never come together.
Yeah, name a good art action movie. Yeah, I can't do it.
Martyrs is a horror film, so
right. That's like the one genre you can't work art into. That's a shame. I kind of wanted that to be good. And then you went and saw, was it Los Angeles Overnight?
Los Angeles Overnight, which is actually available now on demand. Came out on Tuesday. Very strange movie. And it's hard to kind of describe, but it's basically like, if you took it on the surface of the premise, it's basically a straightforward thriller about a young actress in Los Angeles who turns to criminality to try and stay in Los Angeles to help her dream of becoming an actress. She comes across some stolen money that was already stolen from other people in the Los Angeles criminal underworld, and she begins to kind of live out her dreams while these people are setting out to try and find her, get the money back, and take revenge upon her. Straightforward idea, but the director here, Michael Krasolakis, has a lot of artful touches. So the movie begins with this voiceover by Peter Bogdanovich, who plays the lead character, Ariel Brackfield, who plays Priscilla. He plays her hypnotherapist, and he does the entire voiceover throughout the movie in this hypnotic hypnotherapist kind of way, where he's relating things about what she's trying to be hypnotized for, which is trying to build her confidence as an actress, and he's trying to put success into her mind that way. And he's counting down throughout the movie, and he's talking about success, and it's very monotone, but it's very hypnotic and very weird and very kind of a. It's Peter Bogdanovich, so he's got a very interesting, charismatic voice on top of it. And then the movie's got a lot of these weird angles and lots of strange dialogue that doesn't really connect. Lynn Shay is in the movie and has a very strange character in the film that's hard to describe, but she's very integral to how the plot goes on. There's a chase scene in this movie, a foot chase in this movie that is really incredible. It goes on forever. It just keeps going and going and going, and plays off the fact that one of the characters, though he's quite young and handsome, he's a smoker. And that plays into how this scene is going to play out. And I've really was impressed with how dedicated they were to that idea. I like this movie. I think it's interesting. There's kind of some David Lynch touches. There's some Mulholland Drive in this. There's modern noir in this. It's a good movie that's available now on demand and maybe worth checking out. It will not be for everybody. Some people will go, this is a bunch of arty film school nonsense and a basically conventional thriller. But I kind of like that he made a conventional thriller and then did all this arty shit on top of it.
Yeah, I tend to like when they do it to thrillers more so than ballets, yeah. But
is this dirty LA or shiny LA?
Dirty LA.
Okay, so that's the kind of LA that I like, To Live and Die in LA, Nightcrawler, Terminator, that kind of thing, where the film has got a particular stock to it that reminds you that Los Angeles is a piece of garbage.
And I want to mention the lead actress, Ariel Brackfield, is really great. She's got these big, expressive eyes. She's red hair, beautiful woman. And notable about her is she's really fantastic in this movie. Her biggest credit prior to this is a movie called Snake Out of Compton. I have no idea why, but it's Snake Out of Compton, a giant snake in Compton, California.
Awesome.
Is it an asylum picture?
I would be willing to bet.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized, undisputed
classic.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. Since Tomb Raider is.
This is my number three favorite film of all time. Eventually, when we get the book involved, you'll see just how expressive I have about it. But of course, it relates to Tomb Raider. He's the original pop culture Tomb Raider. I'm sure that there were, based on the fact that Indiana Jones was evolved from 1920s, 30s, 40s serials from Lucas and Spielberg, of course, this movie would pay homage to something else other than what it actually is. I love the pacing of this movie. I love the naturalism of the acting. Harrison Ford and Karen Allen have not won Oscars, okay? John Rhys-Davies has not won an Oscar. Paul Freeman has not either, okay? So you've got actors that are very talented, but they never have been recognized at the particular top of a game, so to speak. And the reason why I mention that, it's important to me to note how natural they are together. Karen Allen and Harrison Ford have incredible chemistry. You know, in a particular scene when we first see them on screen together, that there's an entire history between them, and the scene only lasts 3-4 minutes tops. And what you're able to get from that is 10 years prior, they were in a relationship together. that's pretty great. I love Karen Allen as Marion Ravenwood. She's spunky. You believe her as somebody that could work something over on someone. You know, she can hold her liquor against the biggest man from Nepal. As in the adventure itself, as possibly dated as it could be, being that it was made in 1981, it's shot in such a way that every scene involving like gunfire and things like that is got a particular sound and resonance to it. There's a scene in Marion's bar where the Nazis or the German people or whatever, the Nepalese people they've hired versus Indiana Jones, they're shooting against each other, and the sounds of the guns are so loud, like I have to turn down the sound system while I'm watching it. There's a scene later involving a biplane, and Marion gets stuck in there, and Indy has to fight off one guy, and then the German mechanic, this big hulking man who doesn't even have to wear a shirt. That's how large he is. And the sounds in that scene are so particularly great. So, yes, it's from 1981. Yes, it's an action film, but there's also some smarts involved with this. I'm thinking more along the lines of the headpiece of Ra. And yes, they have to read it and go see what it's all about, but the Germans think they're so smart and they're going to recreate it and find where the Well of Souls is, but they're digging in the wrong place because the headpiece has two sides to it and it tells them to kind of kneel before God in a way. There's religion in this, there's action, there's history. It wraps up all into one of the most interesting stories and adventures. The music from John Williams is obviously legendary. There's nothing wrong with this movie in my eyes. Not a single thing that I can say I could do without that, or I would have adjusted this scene to be this.
Why are you staring me down, man?
I didn't. What? I don't know that. I got.
Oh, it's not Josh's.
Oh no, I feel like I'm looking back and forth because to be this effusive about something, as I occasionally am, I like to see what your reactions are because you're either going to shoot it down with like poking holes in the plot, or you're going to say, "Yeah, it's great, but it doesn't stand the test of time." That kind of thing.
I love this movie. I do. Then they say that the movies that you love at 10 years old are the movies you're going to love forever, and it is a thing where you can't take the nostalgic goggles off on certain things, like you and Rocky. And it's
me and Rocky IV.
Rocky IV.
Rocky, I watch more as an adult.
But I love this movie. Watching it this time, I kept doing this. First off, that Big Bang Theory episode where she claims to take apart the entire plot. They say that Amy, the character, has a thing where she mentions that if they could, all this would happen regardless of whether Indiana Jones was there or not. Is this threat not true? Because they never would have found that fucking tomb without him, and that's halfway through the fucking movie. So you're wrong. You're wrong on that one, Big Bang Theory. But there are questions that I have that the movie doesn't answer, and it kept hitting me. How did Indiana Jones know to keep his eyes closed? Where was it introduced anywhere there that he knew to keep his eyes closed?
He knew so much about the stories from the Bible when he's talking to the army guys before.
The Bible has a thing where keep your eyes open, keep your eyes closed if you open the Ark of the Covenant.
It's humility, and it's even referenced again once it gets to Last Crusade, and that be humble before God. He knows that not because he's an active participant in believing in God, but he knows the power of it from going to Sunday school.
It's got
to
be laid in there somewhere. It wasn't laid in there at all. Why did Belloc feel the need to dress up?
He wanted to do everything correctly. In fact,
where did he get all the words? Where did that? Where was that introduced in the movie that he needed to say this chant that he does? Also, why did they even bother to even take this thing and they take it through this like place? Where are they taking it to on this island, and why? Why not just open it in Egypt to make sure it's there?
Remote location. There's a whole like German base there.
But they were at a German base. They left basically what was a German base to go to another place.
They're in Egypt in a dig.
They could have just opened it up right there and gotten the same answer
and gotten too much attention. Going to a remote spot on the water is where I would go.
Until Marion blew everything up, it was just as secure, maybe even more secure than where they went.
Well, quite possibly, but not as remote. attracts less attention when you're in the middle of the water. You know, Germans were very secretive about their stuff. That's why they've got a U-boat taking thing.
I love this movie, but these questions did come up while I watched this.
Of course.
And they aren't addressed in the movie.
I'd like to say that, yes, nostalgic glasses are a huge thing that I like to admit now on the show. Versus before, when I started on the show, I was saying, no, this is really good. I'll tell you why. Okay, whatever. Yes, I watched Indiana Jones a ton when I was younger, but I watched Temple of Doom way more than this. This one was the boring one to me. Like, Empire was the boring Star Wars movie to me when I was younger. So as an adult watching Raiders of the Lost Ark, I appreciate it so much more because it's just so crisp. Like, there's nothing boring about it to me. And even with all of the brown hues and stuff like that, that remind me of things like Lawrence of Arabia, and your eyes can get a little bored looking at sand the whole time. There's just something very charming about every little scene. Sala is a great character, you know? The things that he says, asps, very dangerous, you go first. This stuff is great. Every scene has a little bit of chemistry or a little memorable line. Bad dates. You know, you want to see God? I'll take you there right now. Every scene has something in it that you can remember. And it's not just my rose-colored nostalgia glasses. Rose-colored nostalgia is just Indiana Jones is cool. And then as an adult, I watch this and say, this is a ton of substance and people at the top of their game.
I have to go.
Yeah. Yes, of course. I'm dying to hear what you say about this.
Before I get to the movie, I am bothered by the fact that John Williams just kind of does the same score over and over. I mean, Star Wars, Superman, and this are very, very similar. Just certain notes, they're almost the same score over and over. And they're all legendary, but they're so similar that it kind of bothers me. You can look at each other all day long. It doesn't change it from being true.
I am honestly trying to think about this, and I know that what he starts out with is a hook, just like Harry Potter eventually. There's the one hook, okay? And then you can say that the hooks have something similar to them and that they're horn-based, right?
And they go the same direction, and it's just a very... It's just... I don't know. They sound... You can tell the same guy did them.
He's got a signature, yeah, but like everybody's got a signature. I mean,
and not like the. I mean, this is like more than AC/DC signature.
I don't.
It sounds
I don't
more
know.
Like than an AC/DC song. Sounds alike.
Let me put it this way: the score for The Mission. I'll just take that. Ennio Morricone is one of the greatest scores I've ever heard. Right, but nobody knew. Like, other than if you've seen The Mission,
right.
You don't know that piece of music. You know Indiana Jones. You know Star Wars. You know Jurassic Park, et cetera, et cetera. There's a reason for that because people love it.
Oh, I know. I'm not saying.
And there's a reason why they love it. If you're saying it's because it all sounds the same and we're all programmed to like things that
people
we
love AC/DC. They're probably the most popular rock band of all time.
I am allowing for your point to sink in, and I'm trying to arrive at where you're at whilst recognizing that John Williams still has to come up with something like that.
I think it's a tad dismissive, but I do. But I think it's because it's the same composer. He has, you know, similar notes and similar, you know, he's got a signature style. That it. I think it's a tad dismissive to say it's all the same.
It's all the same the way AC/DC is all the same, I guess is what I would say. I would put them in the same boat in that they're very, very popular. They're very good at what they do, but at the same time, I'm gonna go to
but.
I'm not going to put them in the greatest.
Putting it though into the greatest in terms of the movies, I mean, I think just each one of these things that he's done for these movies is essential to the movie. They would not be the same movie without these scores. That's what makes them so.
I won't disagree
so brilliant.
With that.
That's what makes them so great is that they're such an essential part of why these movies are great.
But I guess that's where it kind of – but it also dumbs it down and makes it more popcorny. I mean, all these movies are blockbuster-type movies. They're not anything more than that. They're just fun action-adventure movies. You know, all some are better than others, but that's what they all are. And I hadn't seen this one in a long time, and I would always call it my favorite Indiana Jones movie. I guess I probably still will, but I was surprised at how bored I was. I was surprised at how – some of the memorable scenes that I remember not being as cool, like the whole sword thing, I thought that was longer. I didn't think he just pulled the sword out and shot him. I thought it was more...
The history behind that scene is so magnificent.
That may be, but in the movie it was so quick. I was like, I thought they were drawing that out a little longer.
It's ad-libbed.
That's fine, but my memory of it was, you know, it was kind of like, you know, you remember how... In my head, it seemed like it was a longer, more... It was just too
He's remembering
quick.
The Family Guy version.
I don't watch Family Guy, but I'm...
The parody versions.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm remembering... Or, you know, the Luke, you're my... Whatever, the Star Wars line they screw up. It's one of those things. And it was just kind of a lot of that, and then downtime, and a lot... And I think of all the fun adventure movies from the 80s. And I'm like, oh, listening to them in my head, I'm like, I like that one better, I like that one better, I like this one better.
Well, Indiana Jones has always been considered, and I've seen this written in many places, and therefore I've adopted it, as the thinking man's adventure hero. And that's why Harrison Ford loves Indiana Jones so much and would play him until he was dead, and has said that on record, but he doesn't like a character like Han Solo as much, because he's a one-note dude. Indiana Jones is multifaceted. He knows multiple languages. He loves the ladies. You know, he's a drinker. He's a fighter. He has to use his intelligence to get in and out of puzzles, and has a serious morality problem and robbing graves and things of that nature. He's a professor, too, for crying out loud. I mean, so he's a multifaceted character. And thus, because people have to think, I get it.
I'm not going to allow that. It's not. I'm not going to go with this thinking.
Okay, finish. Back to the Future, for example. Action film keeps going. The pace is such that you can stick with it most of the time. Ghostbusters, similar fashion. Okay, stuff that we're remembering from the 80s. Raiders of the Lost Ark has some downtime, but the downtime involves scenes that have great moments in them. I'm cool with everything because it's got character to it, right? I don't need to be entertained every 2 minutes of a movie, which is Ghostbusters and Back to the Future. This is... I'm not trying to be pretentious. It's just coming off that way, okay?
I know what you're saying. And I get what you're saying, and you're right. I guess my point is either make Lawrence of Arabia or make Ghostbusters. Don't try to make the two of them at the same time. You know, that's kind of what Sean was saying about that action movie that was trying to be artsy. And I know this isn't really being artsy, but it falls into that. It's a Spielberg Lucas movie. It falls into that fun bubble.
Sure.
And then they're in it. I pick a lane for me. I don't know. I don't know.
You're onto something there in that Lucas is the one that came up with the idea, and he's all like, well, I used to sit in the theater and watch these dudes that didn't have much substance do this and do this and do this. Spielberg comes in and says, yeah, let's make him like a professor. Okay, let's enrich this a little bit. He has the strong knowledge of religious items and artifacts, and the idea of the MacGuffin comes in for every one of these films. And so they've... made it smarter from a very basic idea of what George Lucas had. I think I get what you're saying. I still think that it's the best kind of amalgam that you can have then, because it's not just a throwaway action film. Okay, I'll watch this 10 times out of 10 over Die Hard, for example.
And see, I won't. That's kind of the tough thing for me.
It's weird. That's the thing that's happened as I've gotten older. I'm much, much more of a diehard than an Indiana Jones as I've gotten older. And whereas as a kid, I was Indiana Jones. As an adult, I'm John McClane. I have a hard time now. And again, it's the nostalgia glasses coming on when it comes to Indiana Jones, because I love it so much and I remember it so much as a kid. I do think of it like Back to the Future and Ghostbusters, but I like it more than Back to the Future, and I like it more than Ghostbusters. I like it as much as Empire and as much as Star Wars, but it's in that realm. And as I get older, those movies do move down my list to be replaced by things that aren't nostalgic, the things that I do really kind of believe in more.
And I will say this. I watched it twice, because I watched it the first time because I was going through the top 100 and I see number 3 and I'm like, this is not pure nostalgia. He wouldn't do that. And I'm watching. I'm like, what am I missing? Why is this kind of boring me? And here's another thing I did, which may not be smart. I had a DVD copy watching it on a 4K TV. And I don't know if it just looked, it looked kind of shitty that way.
Absolutely right.
And so that may have played a role in it as well. On top of that, I don't, like, I've seen it a couple times, but I don't have any nostalgia towards it. The other movies, Ghostbusters, Lethal Weapon, Die Hard, I do have a much stronger nostalgia for those movies, which plays a role in why I would definitely take those over.
It's interesting. All three of these movies that we're talking about, Lethal Weapon, Die Hard, Raiders of the Lost Ark, to me, they're the pinnacle of that director's game. You say what you want about Steven Spielberg throughout his career and the importance or the prestige of anything else that he's done. Jaws, to me, would be like right under Raiders of the Lost Ark, okay? Like right there. And I know you'd probably say Jaws is way better. You might even say Jaws is way better, too.
Maybe Schindler's List.
Raiders exists at a time where they're still trying to make things. Like, please like me. Please like me. And trying really hard to take what they have in the script and make it on the screen. Like, how do we do this? How do we do this? And it's more of like an indie film than, say, even Temple of Doom, Last Crusade, where they're having these iconic moments like, oh, you know the whip. You know this. It becomes a huge figure. Nobody knows who Indiana Jones is when Raiders comes out, you know? So it's this new thing. The film is so much more crisp like that. It's organic. And it works because it's an iconic character, but nobody knows he's iconic yet.
And on, I think there's another thing that you have with it that you know is more than a movie, too. You know the outside stuff. You know, stuff that I have with Kevin Smith where I know behind-the-scenes shit, and it adds on to that for me, too. And I have none of that for
Harrison Ford having dysentery caused that scene. He was so sick, and they had to shoot. And he was a trooper, and he said, ugh, in one cut, he just uses blanks guns, and the guy falls back, right? And he worked with him, and then they're like, wait, that's way better than what we have on screen, which is going to be a drawn-out battle. His hat kept falling off when he was on the horse, and so he stapled the hat to his head. That's so awesome. I mean, it's just a piece of film history, right? Harrison Ford loves this character so much. He's so much more dedicated to Indiana Jones than anything else that he's ever done.
I will say, I think I like Star Wars better, or there are two or three of the movies.
It's a miracle.
But you like Raiders better, so is it really?
Raiders is just a crisper film than Star Wars. It's weird. It just is. It's flawless. I tried really hard to find something with Raiders
and
that I could
maybe
argue
I need
about.
To watch it with like a 4K version instead of a DVD because it really did look shitty. I mean, it, and I know that part of it's the up convert that it's trying to do on the DVD.
Yeah, and they don't have Indy on 4K yet, but on Blu-ray,
or
it
Blu-ray.
Really looks spectacular. Most Lucasfilm releases look spectacular on Blu-ray. There's no edits to this film because it's a Spielberg film. So
I was going to say the edit I have, he shot him with a walkie-talkie.
Which Indy shot first.
Isn't that what they did in E.T.? They took all the guns out and put walkie-talkies in.
Yes.
But no, I mean, it was... Because I didn't like it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm coming at it from this angle. I just thought I was going to like it way more than I did, I guess, is where I don't know.
I'm so glad that we finally got to it in depth on the show, and this conversation has been great for me, because now I can shut up about it for years.
Number 18 in 1988. Squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck in 1988.
Squeezed and pulled and hurt your neck in 1988.
1988.
Oh, okay. Five movies this week. Police Academy 5, Assignment Miami Beach. Let's skip it. Okay.
I did.
Yeah, I've seen it before. It's stupid. There's not even TNA, so to speak. You know, if you wanted to go and do a Police Academy film for dumb fun and whatever, that doesn't even exist. Bobcat Goldthwait may or may not be there. I can't remember. He's the only thing redeeming about 3 or 4, you know? If that would be redeeming. He's yelling at everything. And Michael Winslow's in it, if you like the noises. Dominic and Eugene is another film that came out this weekend, and I didn't get a chance to watch it. Stars Ray Liotta, Tom Hulce, and Jamie Lee Curtis. And that sounds like a very interesting combination. Ray Liotta and Tom Hulce are brothers. and one falls in love with Jamie Lee Curtis, and then how they manage the fact that Ray Liotta's looking after Tom Hulce, it seems like. But I don't know where this can be found. Have you seen it?
No.
No, okay. Then also, we've got DOA. And I couldn't find this movie anywhere. It's not available to stream. It's not available on Netflix. Like, I even thought about going to the store, and of course I'm not going to find DOA sitting on the shelf anywhere, but it seems to be a remake of a 1950s film, which is also called DOA, Dead on Arrival or whatnot.
You watched that one, and
that one is available on Prime.
You didn't watch it, though.
Did not watch it.
Good, good.
Of course not. The 88 version stars Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan, and it appeared to be something kind of sultry and noirish. He plays an English professor, but if you really buy Dennis Quaid as an English professor, good for you. I don't, for what that's worth.
He has the Harrison Ford vibe to him. I don't know.
Hey, now. On the hierarchy of very handsome men that could sport a mustache, like Harrison Ford, Tom Selleck, Dennis Quaid. Tom Selleck being mentioned because he was originally Indiana Jones.
Quaid doesn't have an iconic mustache.
No. I'm saying dudes that could sport a mustache because they're very handsome and rugged looking and look good when they're young, look good now.
And Selleck's number one, not Harrison but Ford.
Quaid, I can't even imagine him with a mustache.
Wyatt Earp.
Yeah, I could see.
Doc Holliday.
Kurt Russell really would be.
Yeah, that's much better.
Maybe. I still Tom Selleck's got to be number one, but then Kurt Russell, then maybe Harrison.
Anyways, completely.
Liam Neeson, I don't know.
Liam Neeson? He can't have a mustache. Exactly. What are you talking about? It's ridiculous.
I know, he still can't have one that he, I don't.
I was expecting DOA when I watched it to be something like The Big Easy with Dennis Quaid and Ellen Barkin, something sultry and hot and sexy. A lot of sweaty people, perhaps, involved, but I didn't get a chance to watch it. What I did watch, two films, one of them called Little Nikita, stars Sidney Poitier and River Phoenix. Now, the title is kind of silly, okay? They should have just called it Nikita or something like that. That would have been more interesting. Playing 1988, we're getting towards the end of the Cold War. Towards the end. And so
over Rocky already ended it.
You see how this movie is irrelevant then. But Poitier plays an FBI agent who's tracking the Russian spy that killed his partner. And in the process of investigating that, comes across this odd scenario where somebody's applying for the Air Force Academy. Somehow Sidney Poitier is in charge of that. I don't quite get it. But in referencing his parents have an odd death date and a birth date based on their IDs, and so that cues him that perhaps his parents are Russian sleeper agents, played by Richard Jenkins and someone else that I can't remember her name. If you buy Richard Jenkins as a former Russian spy, then good for you. I don't, but the film is more about the relationship between Poitier and River Phoenix, and River Phoenix once again shows like that he could have been one of the best actors if he had survived. He's really energetic. He owns the screen, and he's got that kind of look that tells me I would have loved to have seen him act into his 30s and 40s doing iconic roles. Okay, the film itself relies on a lot of our predisposed notions towards what Russia is and what Russia does. Richard Bradford, who we'll talk about in just a moment in another movie from 88, plays the Russian super agent or whatever that's controlling all these sleeper spies. It relies on a lot of typical 80s tropes. Have you seen this one?
No.
Okay. I wouldn't recommend it other than if you're interested in seeing additional work of what River Phoenix did. And the last one from 88, it's a Robert Redford film called The Milagro Beanfield War. And I was reading...
And no one remembers it because Robert Redford's not in it.
You are correct. But everyone else is. I mean, like Reuben Blades, Richard Bradford, Melanie Griffith, et al. This was labeled by Amazon as a comedy. And so I'm watching the first 5-10 minutes in this dour town that's not like experiencing anything other than poverty. Like, this is not a comedy. But I kind of get it.
It is if you're rich.
that's the thing. It's you've got a small town that's going to be overrun by Richard Bradford, who's going to make a golf course in a recreation area near their area. And one very frustrated citizen of the town of Milagro decides to open up the irrigation to his father's bean field. And he starts growing beans, and that's against the law. But Reuben Blades, as the sheriff, is like, yeah, well, what are you going to do? Stop him? Well, you can't do that because that could turn the town against you, and that could be bad publicity, and you're trying to get this thing done. The movie is really well done. I found myself surprisingly enjoying all of the quirky characters from this town of Milagro, including an old man played by a 70-some-year-old Mexican actor that I can't think of his name off the top of my head. A very interesting character who talks to dead people. It's like Don Quixote in a way, that kind of a weird humor going on, and it's got a quirkiness to it that I really dug. Robert Redford as a director has always at least intrigued me, if not really impressed me. And this one, with the title called The Milagro Beanfield War, that sounds like something I would never want to watch. I mean, something I would have to read, you know, something that was like that Sam Waterston movie from a couple of years ago. You know what I'm
saying?
The Killing Fields. Like, why would I ever watch this, you know? But it actually turned out to be really good and the best surprise of the week.
You ever see it?
No. I've never seen that one. It I didn't have a chance to get to it this week.
It's available to rent, should you so desire, but it's actually a surprisingly good film.
All right, that's 1988. Next week, we have Midnight Sun, Pacific Rim 2, Paul, Apostle of Christ, and Sherlock Gnomes, Maybe Unsane. Therefore, our classic is, I have it written down and I've already lost it.
What was Eternal it? Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Right, because that was the last movie that we need to see to finish out. That I need to see if it would possibly crack my top 15. and then our top five.
Top five is top five giant robot or Jesus movies.
Or
a combination, yes.
If you can find Jesus and giant robots.
Mech or Jesus. If you find it, tell us, please.
Because I want to see it.
Yes.
and then I want to thank our Patreon supporters. Or do you have anything from 88? You want anything worth mentioning?
Next week? I don't know.
That's all right. A lot of movies from 88 might come out. But I do want to thank our Patreon supporters. If you want to be a supporter, ihatecritics.net/Patreon. We'll start with our key grip, Charlie Messing. And then another. Our character actors, Josh and Christina.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effects level, Corey.
May the force be with you.
Our associate producer, Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars, Dave Sievers and Uncle Jeff.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
If you want, like I said, if you want to be a supporter, it is the best way to help the podcast. ihatecritics.net/Patreon. And then go to iTunes, subscribe, write and review the show. We'll read the review on the air. And ihatecritics.net/Amazon to be an Amazon, to help us out on Amazon. And then we do have a bonus episode out there. It is on Patreon now. It's also at Bandcamp. I do not have a link posted, but I will eventually if you wanted to buy it for $1. Or you can go to Patreon and it's there as well. And if you're on Patreon and you haven't heard it or you can't find it, send me a message on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram and I'll get it to you. Anything else?
No, that's all I got.
Johnny B. Goode and Biloxi Blues are the two notables from 88. Both made over $20 million, and I'll be watching both of those.
All right.
If I can find them.
All right, that's our show. Stick around after the credits to see where Raiders of the Lost Ark ends.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. That's right, the three best friends that anyone
can have. All right, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Batman Returns.
Raiders.
Raiders.
Raiders of the Lost Ark Inception.
Raiders.
Raiders.
Sure. I don't. Pan's Labyrinth or Raiders.
Trying to pull the nostalgia goggles off, and it's hard. Pan's Labyrinth.
Raiders.
It's Pan's Labyrinth for
there
me.
There are only two choices that can defeat my Raiders, so.
Raiders, Dark Knight.
Dark Knight.
Raiders.
Surprisingly, it's Dark Knight for me. Raiders, Lethal Weapon.
Raiders.
Raiders.
Lethal Weapon. Raiders, War of the Worlds.
Raiders.
Which War of the Worlds? No, Raiders.
2005, but yes, I'll go Raiders. Raiders, The Terminator.
Raiders.
Raiders.
Yeah, maybe. Raiders, Ghost.
Raiders.
Raiders.
Raiders, Boogie Nights.
This nostalgia goggles again.
Boogie Nights for me.
It's hard. Raiders.
Raiders.
Moved up to 121 between The Dark Knight and Boogie Nights.
Reasonable.
All right. Bye.